On Tech News Today, Apple wants Samsung to pay $40 for every patent-infringing phone they sell. One parent wants Google to pay for the apps her own kid downloaded. And a blogger wants the world to know that the One Laptop Per Child project is dead. All that and more coming up next.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
It's Tuesday, March 11th, 2014, and this is Tech News Today. Tech News Today is brought to you by RingCentral, a cloud-based phone system we use here at Twit. And it just got better with the launch of Meetings, the full-service video conference feature. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral starts at under $25 per month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial and buy one desk phone, and you get second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit ringcentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Mike Elgin.
And I'm Jason Howell.
On Tech News Today, we explore the big tech stories of the day in conversation with the world's best journalists. And speaking of the world's best journalists, our guest co-anchor today is Dan Gilmore. Dan teaches media literacy and entrepreneurship at Arizona State's Walter Cronkite School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And he also writes a weekly column for The Guardian, which I personally enjoy reading quite a bit. Welcome, Dan.
Good to be here.
Now, you're working on a book. I've heard vicious rumors to the effect that you are working on an extremely relevant book.
Well, it's the tentative title of it. It's called "Is Permission Taken?" And it's about who controls our technology and communications, whether we do at the edges of the networks or whether companies in the middle and governments are going to control it. And I'm afraid we're going in the wrong direction right now.
I think that's pretty clear. When do you expect that to be out on the market? I know that authors hate that question, but I'll ask it anyway.
I have no idea.
Okay.
I may be putting some Kindle singles out along the way. Still up in the air on that question.
All right. Well, I'll look forward to reading it when it does come out in whatever form. Let's get into the news. Apple wants Samsung to pay $40 for every patent-violating phone they sell. A transcript posted on Florian Mueller's Foss Patents blog shows that Apple will demand that amount for each of Samsung's phones found to violate up to five Apple patents. Florian Mueller is an intellectual property activist and analyst, and he joins us to tell us about this post. Welcome, Florian.
Hello, Mike.
Now, can you tell us more about the context for Apple's demands?
Yes, the context is the trial that will start in the Northern District of California on the 31st of the month. And the hearing that I reported on today was actually already held in late January, but it took me a while to obtain the official public transcript.
Well, first of all, why did it take a while? Shouldn't that be readily available?
The documents that the parties file, the judge's orders, those are actually available immediately on PACER, which is the System for Electronic Access to Court Records. But transcripts are a little more difficult to obtain. You have to order them from the court, or you have to send somebody there and obtain a copy, and that can sometimes take a while.
Now, I'm completely confused about this this demand, essentially, because wasn't the price that Samsung was expected to pay already determined in a previous case?
Yes and no. It was determined for the patents at issue in that first case, which were three software patents as well as various design-related rights. But in the new trial, you will mostly see different products. I don't want to say new products because they are all pretty old. They are the newest ones of those are still 2 years old, but different products and especially a different set of patents. The damages award in the first case was largely attributable to the fact that holders of design patents are entitled to certain types of damages. One theory is called disgorgement of infringer's profits that are not available for technical patents. So the damages award in the first trial is due to the specific rules for design patents, but no design patents are at issue in the second one that we will see later this month.
Now, it sounds outrageous that they're asking for $40 per phone, but isn't this pretty standard legal procedure? It's kind of like a negotiating position. You demand a huge amount in the expectation that hopefully that'll get you a little bit more. I mean, essentially, this is a jury trial, right?
Yes. To some degree, to some extent, it is perfectly legit and understandable, and everybody does it. What is not par for the course, though, is to really ask for an amount for five patents and declare this to be a royalty that Samsung would have paid at the end of a reasonable negotiation if that amount for five patents exceeds what you once asked for your whole portfolio of thousands of patents, and if it's also in contradiction to the positions Apple has taken in this litigation with Samsung in this case and other cases when Samsung's patents are at issue. Also, even though parties obviously have a desire to present very ambitious demands to the jury in hopes of then getting a certain percentage of it, the court actually has the role of the gatekeeper. And there are certain rules in place under which courts, it's called the Daubert proceeding, under which courts would actually usually prevent a party's counsel from making totally outrageous demands. And if you read the transcript, you can see that Judge Koh was not necessarily a big fan of those numbers, but at the end of the day, she did not actually issue an order that would have required Apple to go back to the drawing board and come up with a different set of numbers.
Hmm. Interesting. Now, Dan, I'm curious if you have you follow or care about the Apple Samsung patent mess and also the sort of litigation in the smartphone industry in general. And if you have some views you'd like to share on any of that.
Well, this case is one of the things that brings really to the front the kind of outrageous place that we are in patent system in general. It's completely broken. If there are thousands of patents that may be applied to any mobile phone, some of them, if not many of them, are just bogus, should never have been granted in the first place. The system is broken, and this is a good example of it. I think the numbers, of course, that Florian is describing sound ridiculous, but I think we're at a place in patent system where we really need to fix it, and at the moment, not too much is being done.
Now, Florian, I want to thank you for coming on and also for digging up that little nugget of information. It's extremely interesting in light of the forthcoming case, and again, thanks for coming on Tech News Today.
Thank you for the invitation, Mike.
You can find Florian at FossPatents.com. That's FossPatents with two S's. And also on Twitter at FossPatents. Well, in a sec, we're going to talk about Google's big day in court. We talked about Apple's big day in court. Google's next. But first, I want to tell you about RingCentral. RingCentral is the cloud-based phone system that we use here at Twit, and they are a sponsor of today's show. RingCentral starts at under $25 per month per user. And if you compare that to the old-school style PBX system, it is a fraction of the cost, and it's way easier to do. Here at Twit, everything is cloud-based. So, of course, when Leo built the studio, he wanted to make sure the phone system was cloud-based as well, and that's why we went with RingCentral. It has zero startup costs, no PBX hardware to install or maintain, which is really probably one of the best things about it. And now RingCentral has launched Meetings. So in addition to all that we love about RingCentral, the receiving voicemail through email, sending and receiving fax messages, and so on, including the auto receptionist who greets our callers, they now offer Meetings, which is a face-to-face meetings system that gives you meetings in high def. You can share desktop documents with anyone, anytime, anywhere, on any device. So it's very useful and handy. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing under $25 a month per user, and you can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial. They also have a special for listeners of Tech News Today. When you buy one desk phone, you get a second phone free up to 20 phones, So call this number designated for listeners of Tech News Today. That's 800-543-9980, 800-543-9980. Or you can go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. Well, Google is being taken to court over apps in the Play Store that allow in-app purchases by children. The class action suit was filed on behalf of all parents whose children have brought apps, who have bought apps on Google's Play Store without mom's or dad's permission. In addition to those kids being grounded, this case is apparently headed for the courts. Jeff John Roberts writes about legal and intellectual property issues for GigaOM. Welcome, Jeff.
Hi, Mike. Good to be here.
Apple settled a case with the Federal Trade Commission recently over in-app purchases by minors. Is this case essentially the same as the Apple case?
Yeah, it looks pretty familiar. The best way to put it is it's a term called bait apps. That refers to companies, unscrupulous ones in my view, that design kids' games that are free or 99 cents, but induce children to buy things to keep the pet dog alive or to keep the fish alive. And kids often don't really understand the implications of buying digital bones or fish. But since their parents' credit card is often hooked up to those same fish or bones or whatever they're buying, the parents get the bill.
Now, as I understand it, there's a 30-minute delay after you enter a password on the Play Store, during which time a child can go in without a password and buy these apps and buy other things in the apps. Isn't it really the parents' responsibility to know what their kids are doing with smartphones? Shouldn't they be teaching their kids to just go ahead and let their virtual pets die?
That's what some of my commenters say, and that's a fair point. I mean, if you give a kid a tablet and say, have fun with this, you should probably know what they're up to. That said, I think it is rather unscrupulous behavior on the part of these app designers. That's specifically what they're trying to do. The parent, I think, can be forgiven not knowing that a kid's game called Pet Hotel or, you know, Magic Fish or something is full of in-app purchase opportunities. And in that window where the kid will be asked, do you want to buy more bones, yes or no? I don't think it's too much to ask to require them to force the parents to enter the password once more. That's Apple's changed its policy after being sued, granted. And Google, the 30-minute window, I'm an Apple user, not a Google Play user, but the lawsuit claims that there's this 30-minute window. Once the parent approves it the first time, the window's open for 30 minutes, and that's when the game maker tries to lure the kid into buying the digital detritus of whatever.
And Dan, if you were judge and jury on this thing, what would you do require, if indeed you would require anything of Google? What do you think the responsibility is of the, you know, not even the app creator, but the company that owns the store where these apps are purchased?
This seems to be a case where Google should be exercising more due diligence on behalf of its users. I somewhat believe that the parents are largely responsible themselves, and I would love to see some of these app developers get taken to court and lose everything. That would be a big benefit here. But it feels to me like Google really should do something to fix this, and I don't think it's a big deal to have people re-enter the password.
Now, Jeff, is the addictive nature of this has been brought up in the lawsuit, as I understand it, the addictive nature of these games. Addictive games are something that is kind of affecting not only kids and teenagers, but also adults. Is there any remedy suggested in the complaint here that the games are somehow predatory because they're addictive?
Well, the complaint repeatedly refers to the word luring, and I think there's something in that. We're talking about children. I mean, if you want to go play Candy Crush all day or mortgage your house to buy more digital goods as an adult, well, I think that's your problem. But I think the kid in this case was allegedly 5 years old, and I think there's sort of consumer protections for how advertisers, marketers target children in other realms. And generally, there's sort of a presumption that the rules are different for younger kids. So in this case, I don't know if I'd use the word predatory, but I think there is something untoward going on.
Now, I understand that the Apple case was settled with the FTC, and I'm not sure where they came in after the, I believe it was a class action lawsuit in that case as well. Do you think the remedy will be identical here ultimately? I mean, wouldn't that make sense?
I think it would probably follow suit. It's a question of how much larger. I believe Apple is a lot bigger than Google Play in terms of these sort of games. I'm not sure. So the amount of damages might reflect that. In the Apple case, they settled for $5 million in the class action, and then the FTC dinged them for another $31 million. That last part, the FTC dimension, might have been political in the sense that Apple hasn't played ball with the government in other areas. And so the government does have discretion who to investigate, who to fine. But I predict the class action suit, if the facts are the same, indeed, as the Apple ones, we can likely expect a settlement, and then it'll be up to the discretion to the FTC, whoever's running it these days, whether or not to go and sort of wring some more money out of Google for violating child's consumer protection laws.
All right, Jeff. Well, thank you for coming on Tech News today to explain this to us. We'll be watching the case, and you can find Jeff's story at GigaOhm.com. And again, thanks, Jeff, for coming on.
Thanks, Mike. Always a pleasure.
Well, a man named Wayan Voda says the One Laptop Per Child project is dead. The OLPC is a nonprofit organization offering an inexpensive laptop designed for children in developing countries. Voda, who founded the blog OLPC News back in 2006, wrote in a post this morning that, quote, "It's time to face reality. The X01 laptop is history." The X01 laptop being the current iteration of the One Laptop Per Child project. And Dan, this is an interesting development because this project has kind of been declining, kind of been fading away for a long time, and nobody has actually been able to come forward and say definitively, nobody in who's a significant part of the conversation over this project has been able to say, okay, this thing is over. You know, what do you think is causing its demise?
I think Moore's Law is generally what's causing the demise of projects of this sort, the relentless progress in hardware, and that we get better, faster stuff all the time with more storage, more capability. And we're certainly a long way from a one laptop per child world. But Moore's Law, over time, makes the hardware very cheap, verging on free at some point.
That's a great point. I mean, in hindsight, the idea that a company who wanted to put laptops into the hands of children would actually design the hardware, design the, you know, build the whole thing from scratch almost in order to make that happen seems a little bit ridiculous at this point because there are so many devices available of every description.
I wouldn't go with ridiculous. I thought that the project was really quite wonderful in its own way. It was a reference platform, I thought, more than anything else, just showing us what could be done. And I think we should see, you know, 1,000 iterations of this kind of thing until eventually we get it right. But it was a lovely little device. If you ever got to play with one, they thought about it hard. They did a lot right. the fact that technology and history overtakes them, I think we should give them nonetheless a great deal of credit.
I think that's a great point. And one of the, you know, you talked about the great little device. They also had a design that they sort of developed and showed mock-ups of, which I thought was super exciting and should have been, and perhaps maybe still is, the future of mobile devices, which is that you can imagine a clamshell device which could be used as a laptop, where the bottom, instead of having a physical keyboard, was a virtual screen. But when you made it flat, it was a larger tablet, essentially doubling the screen size, and it could be used as a tablet either by a single user or by two users, with the orientation for half the screen toward one user and half the screen toward the other user, kind of like they're playing a battleship or something like that. And then you could pick it up and hold it like a book, open like this, and it would be essentially an e-book. That was a really exciting concept where you'd have a lot of creative use and common sense use for two screens in a foldable clamshell device. I don't believe anybody ever built that one, though.
I don't know of anything like it. And again, I think the marketplace, both for profit and not for profit, has come up with a lot of great ideas. And maybe we need a giant contest where there's some real significant winnings to come up with the next version of one laptop for everybody or one device for everyone. But, you know, we're at the moment we're heading to a world where that's the one device for everybody and on and on. But it's not the last word in screens. We're going to see this stuff change. I very much applaud what these people have done, even though it didn't take over the world the way they had hoped.
Now, one of the primary founders was Nicholas Negroponte from MIT, I believe, and Wayan Voda, the blogger we began speaking about at the beginning of this section, says that he's gone off to work on a different project called the Global Literacy XPRIZE Project, which sounds certainly worthwhile. And also he pointed out in his piece that the OLPC Miami group is still servicing major deployments in Uruguay, Peru, and Rwanda. So it's not dead. It's just his major point is that for anybody wanting to embrace this platform and do something, it's really not a compelling platform anymore, and nobody is really doing it. So I agree with you, Dan, completely. Hopefully, the goal of the OLPC is alive and well, and that we'll get some real funding behind it. You know, we certainly spend a lot of money internationally on lots of other things, including the military and other things that may be less required if kids are better educated and have more options in their life and in their career. And John just handed me, for those of you watching the video, this is what the device looks like. And so this is a really compelling device here.
Thank you.
You look at this. That's pretty cool. It has antennas. It's bright green. It's really cool. And I'm sure kids love it. And I hope that the kids currently using it are getting a lot of miles out of it. Well, a judge yesterday blocked plans by the National Security Agency to destroy surveillance phone records. The ruling came after the Electronic Frontier Foundation asked the court for a temporary restraining order today and said that the records might be useful as evidence in lawsuits challenging NSA surveillance. And, of course, the reason for their imminent destruction was essentially a rule by the FISA court that requires the NSA to not hang on to data for more than 5 years. It sounds to me, Dan, like this was the right or at least a positive move by the judge. We do need this stuff for evidence. What do you think?
In the particular case, of course, I agree with you. It's the right ruling. You know, how many different ironies we could point out in this situation. But you know, I think it's hilarious that the NSA would be, you know, objecting only when, you know, data is not being kept for the purposes of showing what they're doing. You know, it's all crazy. But the judge made the right decision.
Yeah, absolutely. And the thing that bothers me about all of this, and of course this was touched upon yesterday by Edward Snowden in his talk at South by Southwest, which is that, you know, yeah, the judge orders the NSA to do something. They order the NSA to do something else. Who knows what they're actually doing? What is the oversight that that enables us to know exactly what they're storing, what they're not storing? What is the oversight that enables us to know what they're hacking and what they're not hacking? I mean, this is an organization that has existed for decades, and their specialties are breaking encryption and stealing secrets. And so it's very, very difficult. And I, to in just a little minor tangent, if you don't mind, Dan, but you know, I kind of disagree with Edward Snowden. His major point was that we can't rely on the politicians, we can't rely on the citizens, we can't rely that much on the companies. What we really need is for technologists to make it physically impossible for mass surveillance to take place because the encryption is so great and because everybody's using Tor and so on. I agree with him that needs to happen in the industry. The industry needs to step up and make the default mode be highly secure instead of having it be an opt-in thing for only experienced geeks.
Yeah.
I support that position, but I think to an even larger extent, this is a political issue. This is a citizen issue. What do you think about his comments generally about this being a technological issue primarily?
I think he would also probably say that there's a major political components of this. The technology part that I believe is absolutely essential, and I agree with them on this, is that if we put in encryption everywhere, make it kind of the default, we make mass surveillance much more difficult. What they're doing now is mass data collection and surveillance. We're kind of scooping up everything. If it becomes a lot harder to do that, if it's more expensive, which is what encryption does, it makes it much more expensive to collect everything from everyone, then the presumption is that they would have to focus on the actual bad guys instead of collecting everything from everyone. So to that degree, I completely believe that that's the right approach. Let's make it expensive to surveil good people so that they have to focus on the people they've identified as potential bad people.
Another component to that, too, is that one of the criteria that the NSA apparently uses to determine who's a bad guy and who isn't a bad guy is the degree to which they use encryption. If somebody uses encryption today, it's pretty likely that they consider that suspicious behavior. And so that's yet another reason why it's important for secure encrypted communications and secure devices to be the default for
That's right.
everybody, because otherwise the people using it, who are essentially doing the right thing and using encrypted communications, become suspects. And so, you know, this is a big issue going forward, and I certainly hope that that people will get involved and be heard on this issue in Washington. Well, a New York Times journalist named Albert Sun posted a story today about his experience with self-tracking using quantified self gadgets. The story is called The Monitored Man, and here he is to tell us about it. Welcome, Albert.
Hi, it's good to be here.
So why the heck did you do this?
Well, I work on the health desk, and I think, you know, these things have been written a lot in technology journalism, but it hasn't really been looked at from a sort of different perspective and how they motivate people and, you know, how they might make you more self-aware of your own health.
Now, you were wearing multiple devices at once for, what, 6 months?
Yeah, I think I tested 10 or 11, depending on how you count them.
And you must have been super motivated then with all these things nagging you about your health and your activity level.
Not really. After a while, everything sort of fades into the background. And, you know, I think that's partly by design, and that's partly the way that someone should sort of interact with these. I mean, they're tools. They helped me understand what I was doing better, but I tried not to let them nag me too much.
What are the downsides or limitations of this category of product? I mean, it's a fairly new product, and as we get into, you know, general wearable computing, these are going to be skewed toward quantified self and personal health monitoring. You know, are there aspects of them that were inconvenient or unprofessional or you know, battery life, any sort of those kinds of issues that you noticed in general for the category?
Well, so one issue is that they're almost all based solely on accelerometers, and those are good at measuring motion and really only certain types of motion. They're good at counting steps. They're very good at counting steps, but once you move beyond that, there are some accuracy issues. But sort of the bigger problem is that this quantified self category is really only super useful for about 10% of people, and that's from some researchers I talked to in Boston at the Center for Connected Health, where they've been doing clinical studies having people wear these to see if it can change their behavior. And really, for most of the population, looking at data that's collected that way is not going to be that helpful unless something else is added on top of it. And I think it's exciting that that's the stage we're at and people are working on how to figure that out.
Well, it's an interesting article. I enjoyed reading it, and I thank you for coming on the show, Albert.
Thank you.
You can find Albert's writing on the NewYorkTimes.com website and also on Twitter at Albert Sun. That's S-U-N. Thanks again. Well, in a sec, we're going to hear from a reader, and we're also going to hear about the most boring application for virtual reality ever imagined. But first, I want to tell you about Personal Capital. Personal Capital is a website that lets you get control of all of your financial life, get everything into one place so you can see how much money you have and where you're spending it, which is very, very important. It's a free and secure tool, and it solves two barriers to growing your wealth. The first barrier is that it's hard to keep track of all of your stuff, stocks, 401ks, bank accounts, the usernames, passwords, and this becomes a barrier to you going and checking in on your own information. The second is that you probably pay someone to manage your financial life, and you're probably paying way too much. Personal Capital brings all your accounts and assets onto one single screen on your computer, phone, tablet, and in real time with intuitive graphs. It shows you how much you're overpaying in fees and how to reduce those fees, and you also get tailored advice on optimizing your investment. So don't wait. Sign up. It just takes a minute, and it'll pay big dividends. I use it myself, and it is very, very pleasant to use. It's great to know what's going on with your money. To set up your free account, go to personalcapital.com/TNT. And remember that Personal Capital is free, and it's the smart way to grow your money. You must go to personalcapital.com/TNT, and we thank Personal Capital for their support and for sponsoring Tech News Today. Well, we have some voicemail from a viewer slash listener named David in San Jose. Do we have that queued up? Let's go ahead and listen to that.
Mike, this is in reference to show 958. This is David in San Jose. You mentioned the First Amendment with respect to Facebook limiting gun posts. The First Amendment is the Congress abridging free speech. It has nothing to do with a corporation. It is the government. So it has nothing to do with the First Amendment because it's not a government entity. It's Facebook Corporation. Anyways, a very common mistake that is made, including by Hank Williams Jr. on Monday Night Football. Thanks.
All right. Well, Hank Williams, we forgive you. This is in reference to the controversy that popped up last week with Facebook and their new stance against the sale of guns to minors across state lines and other illegal uses for Facebook in terms of selling guns. And we referred to it, said that it touched on First Amendment and Second Amendment issues. And I think that that's generally true to the extent that, you know, the question at hand is Facebook, our social networks, a comic? I mean, the government is not allowed to meddle with free speech in the, quote, public square. And the question is Facebook, our social networks, a public square? And if they are, then they are not responsible for all the hate speech and bullying and violence and illegal conversations that go on. If they're not, if Facebook is a private playground, then in fact they theoretically could be sued or are responsible for all the nasty stuff that anybody says on those social networks. So to a certain extent, it ultimately will become a First Amendment issue because the government is in the position of deciding what is essentially a public square and what isn't. And we haven't really determined that online. And so that's something we'll be watching. But it is good, David, thank you for clarifying that. And yes, the First Amendment and the Second Amendment are about limiting what the government can do, not limiting what Mark Zuckerberg can do. Well, in one of the most boring applications of virtual reality ever conceived, the Oculus Rift VR headset may be soon put to use to simulate the experience of shopping for groceries. A company called Figure Digital, is using Oculus Rift to enable virtual shoppers to virtually walk around a virtual Tesco. Tesco is a major UK grocery chain. Even if this could somehow lead to actual products being purchased, would an online store, kind of like Amazon, be better? What's so great about walking down the aisle of a grocery store? Pretty fascinating. I was hoping for something more sort of holodeck-like in the coming world of virtual reality and less like shopping at Tesco, but still, hopefully they'll learn something and we'll be able to try it, even if it is boring shopping for tomatoes and canned soup at Tesco virtually. Well, Dan, I want to thank you for coming on today. I always appreciate and really enjoy your columns, and I really appreciate your Twitter feed. You're always out there giving everybody a hard time for being less than transparent, being less than professional in their journalism, and I really appreciate that and also for you being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you can get breaking news every day by following Twit News on Twitter. Subscribe to Tech News Today at twit.tv/TNT. You can email us at tnt@twit.tv. Leave us a voicemail by calling 260-TNT-SHOW and subscribe to our subreddit at technewstoday.reddit.com. Follow our social pages by searching for Tech News Today on Twitter, Facebook, Google+, and YouTube. Also, don't miss our evening newscast, Tech News Tonight, at 4 p.m. Pacific, tonight and every weeknight. My name is Mike Elgin. Thanks a lot. We'll see you tomorrow.